Hello and welcome to another episode of The Other Modern. I'm your host, That Damn Pipsqueak, and I am joined today by Dodger and Cyber. We're going to be talking about this past Grand Prix in New Orleans, and a bit about, you know, how it went for each of us, what decks we brought, why we brought those decks, conclusions that can be drawn from the meta, all of that good stuff. Just kind of a debrief, since the last month was incredibly hectic and our biggest GP yet. So we're going to start off by each talking about what we brought to the GP and why. Dodger, do you want to start us off?
Sure, yeah. So this month has been pretty exciting for MSEM because of many reasons. There's been a huge influx of players. There's been a lot of league activity going on, and also the two new sets were added this month, Alara and Urshad. And I was pretty excited to build decks with them. So I built like around 19, 20 decks, and I put up an article. I gave them to you, and you put up an article of my various brews with the new sets. And I knew I wanted to do something with something from the new sets, but I wasn't sure what. And I ended up playing a couple different. I was thinking about bringing this like blue red Fateful Eruption deck, which was doing some truly disgusting things, like making people sacrifice all their lands on turn four. And I ended up not going in that direction because Simon had this post that was talking about, well, blue red artifact decks are the boogeyman of this GP. And I was like, okay, maybe I don't want to bring this because people will probably tech against me, even though like this deck is not specifically the thing that's being targeted. So anyway, I ended up bringing a different deck. It was Black White Unearth. Unearth and Persevere to cheat out 2 and 3 drops much faster than you normally could. And basically doing this like kind of grindy mid-range style that can also randomly just aggro someone to death with a card like Deadwood Terror.
And Cyber, what about yourself?
So my deck choice was largely inspired by a couple of conversations I had with Pipsqueak, actually. So thank you for that. About how very close to free it is in this format to have a good mana base. And specifically a mana base that can support playing decks with many colors, 3, 4, 5 color decks. And those inspired me to run through the sort of Frank Karsten mana base math. And I realized that actually the mana bases were even freer than we had thought. I like playing control. There were a fair number of good, powerful control, multicolored cards for controlling and particularly tap out style control decks in both new cards in Alara and underplayed cards from Love Song and good cards that have been staples for a while. And so that sort of pushed me towards playing the sort of greediest tap out 5-color control deck I could build.
Could you explain the deck's name? I was always a little curious about that.
Yeah, so the deck's name is a reference to a different card game, Netrunner. NBN or Newsbreaking Networks is one of the factions in that game. NBN, The World Is Yours, is a particular identity card of theirs.
I see.
The name is also intended to refer to the pairing of Terraformer's Globe, the world being referenced, and Glitch Galactic Muse, with Glitch sort of evoking cyberpunk.
Cool. All right. Sweet.
And I was on a deck that is kind of an old staple of mine. And by old staple, I mean for the past couple months, which is Podlight. which is not actually very much like a pod deck, if I'm being frank. But it's a bug color mid-range ramp deck that uses the combination of Ancestral Council, which is a spell seeker, effectively, and What Lurks Beyond, which is effectively Neoform. And using those two cards together is able to have just this absurd redundancy within a toolbox mid-range deck. So you have the ability to consistently find your threats and always find the best threat for a given situation, or reliably find board wipes as one of the other kind of modes on Ancestral Council. And going into this GP, I was really not sure what to play. Since this was a blind sideboard event, I was a little bit nervous about the idea of playing control. A lot of the control decks that I'd been testing had all kind of turned out to suck. And I was deeply worried about, you know, trying to pick the meta and be like, all right, people are going to be on combo and then hit a bunch of aggro decks, or think people were going to be on aggro and then I hit a bunch of mid-range and control decks. I really didn't want to, you know, line myself up wrong half into them. So I picked Podlight because it was a very high agency deck. It was very powerful. I have, you know, like at this point, 4-5, 5-0 finishes with the deck in leagues. And it's incredibly proactive. So if your opponent is doing something that you're not really prepared to deal with, you also can sometimes just run them out of the game. And then after sideboarding, you'll usually have the tools you need to be competitive because you have all of these tutors and, you know, Reclamation Sage-like effects. You can reliably tutor up Grave Hate. The addition of Sacrificial Bull was a huge addition to that deck. I think in the future, Sack Bull is probably main deckable. Actually, briefly, did I?
It's in your sideboard. For this one?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's just in my sideboard. But I think the next build of Poplight I then ran through a league with, it was in the main deck as a one of instead of one of the Croak
Fortress. I think Bull is definitely main deckable too. In any deck.
I'm inclined to agree.
As far as how the GP went for me, however, it was kind of a wash. On paper, my record was 2-3. In practice, it was 3-2, but my opponent in round 5 was 3-1. And so I was dead for top 8, and they weren't. And, you know, Caitlin, who's the pilot, is a new player to MSEM. So I didn't want to dream crush in their first GP. So I, after we played the game out, which was this just incredibly cool and close series between Dredge and Podlight, I ended up, I would have won on paper, but instead I scooped. And that, the top 8 dreams did not last very long for Caitlin. But
sorry about that.
And, but yeah, so my round 1, I hit the blue-red artifact combo deck piloted by Split Moon, which, as was mentioned, was kind of the boogeyman deck going into this GP. I felt like I was reasonably well set up. I had replaced the main deck Vibrant Rapture for a main deck Singularity's Grasp. I had main deck Jade Vault Reclaimers. I had a really specific sideboard strategy that put me in a really good spot. I died game 1, but it was also one of those things like if I had untapped, I would have won the game. So I was like, all right, that was close. And then game 2, I stumbled a little bit, and it was just this incredibly close and tense game, and my opponent had to have the perfect 8 cards. Might have been the perfect 7 cards. It might have been the perfect 8. I don't quite remember, to win through the 2-3 pieces of disruption that I had, but managed to do so. So I started off the GP 0-1 and not in a particularly stellar mood. I then, in my round 2, I played against the black green mid range deck, and
is that Shumbek?
Psychonifu. And that deck, very powerful. It's a Chi Li deck. It has this kind of combo potential. I got there in a fairly close game 1, and then I either died out of nowhere in game two or won game two very handily via Sacrificial Bowl. I can't remember. That is the game where I decided to stop recording for the GP because I played atrociously because I was distracted by a lot of other stuff. So did things such as, I died game one and then won games two and three handily is what happened. Game one, for instance, I died because it didn't actually matter, but I played a Spellseeker or Ancestral Council. And then I just passed the turn. Like I had talked through the line about how I was going to now tutor up What Lurks Beyond. And as I passed turn, I looked at my hand and was like, wait, where's the What Lurks Beyond? And I'd completely missed my trigger. And in game two, I kept a hand and then just straight up didn't play the turn one mana dork that I kept the hand like because of. And it was fine because I just rode Sacrificial Bowl to victory versus the graveyard deck. I had Pith Wilt for a Chi Li in time and it was fine. But it was just one of those things where those two mistakes alone just made me say, okay, cool. No one is ever seeing this replay. And
game three was
a similar running over. Just I drew two Sacrificial Bowls. They both grew out of control. They answered every reanimation attempt that happened. And I just kind of ran her over. So going into round three, I was like, okay, look, I'm 1-1. I'm still alive for top eight. I just need to kind of grit and get through it. And I hit Seismic.
Oh, Bronze's no. Deck. Yeah, Egg was complaining to me about this deck.
So I've gone on record repeatedly as saying, don't play bad cards. This deck does nothing but play bad cards. But it is a deck where all of the bad cards are cheap enough that you don't actually have the issue that happens where you get wrong halved because you have this incredible redundancy. For those of you who aren't familiar with the deck is built around stealing your opponent's permanence through Zagara, through Claimed by the Veil, and through Stolen Cash. Yeah. Thank you. So two of those are Zagara steals anything, Claimed by the Veil steals anything CMC three or less that isn't a land, and Stolen Cash specifically steals lands
or artifacts.
And then it sacrifices. Oh, and then it sacrifices them. So it's kind of this like really whack synergy Ponza deck. And it also happens to be running this just pile of Vibrant Raptures and just generates all of these incidental clues and treasures and then burns you out with the Tithe cards. It doesn't have other win cons.
It's got currency, so, too. Like, it can just outvalue you, too, as well.
Yeah. Well, it can generate value, but it has no win cons other than the burn spells. So it's just 20-ing people with burn spells. Game one, I think I like stumbled a little bit in terms of finding a threat in time, and specifically finding a threat that I could cast. It was one of those things where like I had enough mana dorks that even with my lands getting ponzed, I still had like 4-ish mana, but I couldn't hit 5 mana, and that was the key amount of mana. And then game two, I came in with a really good sideboard strategy. And it just didn't matter.
Is this deck capable of beating someone who gains 5 life?
Yeah, of course. If they don't have lands, like, kill them, right?
No.
So no, technically.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, I feel like this deck really should have like a man land or something.
Yeah. It is.
Like put a Rousing Rumble.
It's one of those things where I'm sure you can optimize that deck further, but it's also one of those things where I died horribly to it, so I don't want to come across as, like, a salty bitch who's just like, well, the deck beat me, so it's bad. But it is a deck where I genuinely couldn't understand, looking at it, why I need to be scared of it. And even having been killed by it, I was like, I'm not sure what went wrong those games. Like, I can't actually point to a specific instance.
I don't know.
Where things...
This deck feels pretty good to me, to be honest.
Well, of course it feels good.
Honestly, I think if I showed this to you and was like, hey, I made this deck, you would believe me, right?
100% in an instant.
This doesn't look like a great deck, but it also doesn't look like a bad deck. It just looks very easy to tech against.
I don't know. Egg told me that he was coming for sadistic indulgence, so watch out, I guess. UNR claims another victim.
That's the thing, is the deck. The deck on paper looks like it's kind of a gimmick deck. It's an engine deck. It really relies on a bunch of these pieces, and they need to stick. But that just wasn't my experience versus it. I had interaction. I was able to remove some of its combo pieces, and the deck kind of just found other copies of those. So, you know.
All right.
Props to Frogmaker for finding a very interesting deck. In round four, I met up against Caillou, both of us in the 1-2 bracket, both of us feeling pretty bad about how the GP had gone. And the game one really just kind of epitomized that GP, where I drew 12-ish of lands plus dorks. It might have been 14. And Caillou drew like 11. And it just, what ended up killing me, God, it was really bad. I ended up dying to Ruin Delver Beats.
As you do.
It was awful. The game was just entirely defined by, at any moment, either of us, if we draw anything that remotely looks like action, they're going to run away with the game. And both of us, despite the fact that we were incredibly consistent decks, you know, Caillou's deck runs a playset of Chilis, 3 Back in the Wilds, and Ayala's Concord. Okay, wait, no, that's actually not fair. Because in addition to drawing those lands, I did draw 3 out of my 4 Pithwelts. And I killed 2 or 3 Chilis with Pithwelts. So Caillou did repeatedly assemble the Chili. And I repeatedly did have an answer. But the game one was just, you know, a total joke. I died, for the record. Which is how you can tell when I'm calling it a joke. No, but... and then games 2 and 3 were kind of how Podlight is expected to go up against interactive decks, where I just was un-one-for-one-able. I just, you know, generated stupid value, got my board, like, answered, and then put it all back onto the battlefield, and just, you know, did the Podlight thing. And game 3 went a similar way. So 2-3, not the worst I've done in a GP in recent memory, but definitely I 2-2, I felt like I hadn't shown the deck its proper respect, especially because Simon, who was also on the deck, just kind of, this month ended up being very busy for him. So he ended up dropping while 1-1. And so I was really, you know, feeling like, well, I'm just tanking the win rate of all of these cards. And then my round 5 was the highlight of my tournament, where I, you know, had this incredibly tense back and forth game. Game 1, I lost because it was Dredge game 1. Game 2, I rode Sacrificial Bull and a bunch of interaction to victory. And game 3, I was staring. I drew 2 back-to-back Snowfield Mothers to stabilize against an entire board of threats. And then at the, you know, right before, I just top-decked a Singularity's Grasp, wiped all the 1-1s away, and swung for lethal in just like one of the coolest turn-the-corner moves. So that felt good. I was very happy with how the GP wrapped up. But overall, I'm very disappointed in how I performed. I don't feel like the deck was a bad choice. I think I got a little bit varianced, but I don't know. I think there's some slight modifications I could have made to the sideboard to make it better. As discussed, I probably should have main decked one of the Sacrificial Bulls. I also feel like I should have been on control, just because I I genuinely like playing Control, but as we'll get into, Control had a really bad showing this GP, so maybe it's for the best that I wasn't on it, especially given some of my past records this month with, or last month with Control. So, I don't know, kind of a crapshoot. Not a great GP, but I was still glad to have participated in the record-breaking size GP. So, you know, all that was neat. Sai, what about you?
Yeah, so I guess I will admit I don't remember all of my matches quite as well as you do, but I will attempt to give, you know, a gist of sort of what I ran into and how things went. So round one, I was up against turn one Soul Rings, Hate Bear Celeste. Very cool deck, by the way. I want to give a shout out to the deck construction there. It's got a lot of neat things going on. Theocracy as an engine is great for driving a hate bear.
I think it's sorry, just to interrupt a little bit. I think it's crazy that this is the only Theocracy. I actually think Theocracy is probably the second most powerful card in Scriptures of Urshad. And I feel like that card is eventually going to take over this format in some way. Or not like take over, but it's going to see a lot more play, in my opinion.
I would also not be surprised to see Theocracy increasing in play. It felt... Dealing with the Theocracies felt crucial to beating that deck.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Please continue.
They were polarizing, but as it happened, you know, Tal matches up really badly into my deck because no matter what you name, most of the things in my deck will miss Tal. Because I've got the diversity of card types. I make enough mana to fight through Spellbane Adepts. I make enough cards that I don't feel too bad about getting 2-for-1 answering Theocracies and Scions. You know, I can just sort of outgrind it, basically.
We
won that. We can imagine. Moved on.
Who'd you play in round two?
Squid Pizza.
That was my deck.
with Dodgers Grixis Parrots deck. Which, despite not being a mirror match, had some of the feel of a mirror match because we were both doing, you know, stupid gold stuff. and the deck felt very good and, in fact, heavily inspired my subsequent league run.
That's good to hear. Because I was a little unsure about it.
The problem with it is that it had too many cards that weren't action.
I can buy that, yeah.
If it's going up against an interactive deck that can take out the key pieces, it ends up with a lot of cards in hand that don't really go anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's generally how a lot of my decks tend to go. Which is fine if they're efficient enough, but sometimes you'll get there.
And it's actually why the version of it I brought to League, you know, isn't running Unearths, isn't running Tear Throughs, isn't running Unquenched Greeds.
Well, I'd say it's like enough of a different deck because it's not trying to do the Morose Harvest thing.
And no, it isn't. Because I think that trying to do the Morose Harvest thing is the biggest problem.
Yeah, probably. I won't argue with you there.
I think the deck's better off just playing good multicolored cards and then Arcanist's Reaver plus Parrot Pulse, because that part of the deck is sick.
I think there's definitely room for a Morose Harvest combo deck, but it probably doesn't need to also be running Parrot Pulse. I think I just shoved the pools in there because you know me.
Yeah.
Round three, I played against Ambrose on Blue-Black Reanimator. And unfortunately, I don't remember a ton of the details of this matchup, but I do remember a pretty glorious moment where I ended up with on the order of a dozen islands after repeatedly killing Shigure the Floodbringer. I lost that game of the match in the end because I, you know, ran out of the ability to do things that weren't mono blue, and I'm not running very many mono blue cards. But you know, the other thing I remember being very scary there is Heart of the Deadwood Chains. Even without me having much of a board to destroy, just a Heart of the Deadwood reanimating another Heart of the Deadwood, reanimating another Heart of the Deadwood, reanimating a Shigure is very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, honestly, it kind of seems like on paper this matchup is pretty disadvantageous for you.
It absolutely is a bad matchup for me. I got extremely lucky. I had, you know, sequences of several turns where I drew board wipe after board wipe after board wipe.
Nice. Yeah.
But yeah, that was a very tough matchup. And the Reanimator deck is definitely, you know.
I mean, Reanimator is legit for sure. Obviously losing Torment Lands hurts the deck, but I think that Reanimator will definitely stick around.
Yeah, it's only running a single play set of a Torment Land, and honestly, the deck is remarkably able to do its thing without the Torment Land.
Yeah, this deck in particular. I'll talk about this later, but the Spellmaster deck I think is very underrated and gets hit a lot by the Torment Land ban.
One brief question. Sai, was it your match where it came up that people didn't realize the thing that about... I can't remember. There was a ruling about Shigure and the fact that its islands, I think, didn't have the name island?
Yes.
Or sorry.
Because...
The islands were...
Because you can... Yeah, still... you can still get Markarth kills with your, you know... six islands with different names.
That is pretty hilarious, honestly.
And so it might be that there was also something where someone was taking damage when they were tapping lands because they didn't realize that island doesn't strip other basics.
So that basics. Wasn't me, because that was something I also abused.
Yeah, I feel like Cyber would know because they were running Terraformers with Globe. Yeah.
And yeah, that's fair. Doing things like turning basics into a different type to get check lands to enter untapped.
That is pretty big brain, I gotta say.
There's a lot of weird tricks you can play with Globe. And, you know, they're small percentage things, but they make you feel...
No, I gotta say, I never would have thought of that. Honestly, until you just mentioned it.
Thanks. Round four, I ran into Dodger and that went very poorly.
Yeah, that first match was pretty lopsided, actually.
Extremely so.
Like, I think the semifinals was, like, actually a really, really good match, but our meeting in round four, I'm pretty sure I won in two games, and neither of them felt that close to me. Maybe the first game?
No, you absolutely crushed me.
I can talk about this later, but, like, that match was 100%, I think the difference is, like, how many copies of out-of-body experience you draw. And in our first match, you drew, like, zero, if I remember correctly. But in the semifinals, you drew, like, you know, two or three per game, so that made it a lot easier for you, I think.
Yeah, I also sideboarded better, mm-hmm. I think. I don't remember what my sideboard plan was in round four. I just remember I wasn't happy with it.
I remember the game where It was game two, and I think I just Curse of the Drowdy like three times.
Yeah. That's and all... I just lost because I just pulled six cards.
Yeah, I did not bring that in for control, but or I didn't put that in my sideboard specifically for control, but it certainly did a good job in that matchup. That card is insane. I feel like people should be playing Curse of the Drow more.
I want to be playing Curse of the Drow decks. Like,
do it this month. That would be my suggestion.
It's almost getting to play him in your MSCM deck, just without the fun part.
Yeah, I mean, really, it is like, it is a better Wrench Mind. It's pretty close to him. The scenarios where it's just a Mind Rot, it's not like unplayable either because it's probably turn four. And I think that like for all intents and purposes, the drawback basically doesn't exist.
Yeah. And then round five, I ran into Crush Castle's Crazy Train deck. And that was a win and in into the finals for both of us. And the Crazy Train deck just didn't get there. It didn't draw enough cards to get its engine running fast enough to not lose to Grasp.
Yeah, I feel like the main deck Grasps must have carried you so hard throughout this GP.
The main deck Grasps did, absolutely.
Yeah, I actually remember I commentated your match. Oh, no, actually, no, that was versus Split Moon. Never mind. Yeah.
Right, next round. But, yeah, no, the Grasps were a big deal, but the other thing that really helped there was just, again, the deck didn't draw as many cards as it looks like it should draw from the deck list.
Huh, okay.
And...
So I did spectate around... sorry, a match with Crush. And the deck absolutely popped off. Granted, it was against Mono Green Ramp, so that's like the dream matchup for Crazy Train. But still, like, I think the deck is pretty scary. And it actually doesn't get hit by any of the bans or nerfs. So I think that deck is definitely something to look out for going forward.
Yeah. It is definitely worth, bringing some way in your main deck to interact with non-creature permanents. Because the deck has a much harder time winning if you can, hit a Hellbent Speed with a Pithwill. If you can, counter the Sage's Ashes. If you can discard even a line out of the hand, it really slows the deck down a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I think that actually the best thing you could have done this GP is be on discard. Just from my own experience, I felt like discard was so good every single match I went into. I think that's what we can talk about that more later, but yeah.
Yeah, I'd believe it. And so, that got me into the finals. I faced Split Moon on the Boogeyman and got to benefit from my main deck Grasps.
Yeah, well, I remember...
as well as my just high density of interaction.
So I remember a specific play from your match when I was commentating it. And the play was basically, I don't remember exactly, but actually had a choice between continuing to develop their board or going for a play that would win them the game if you didn't have Grasp, or auto lose them the game if you did have Grasp. And I think they did this both games, and both games you had the Grasp. Which is sort of like, okay, cool. Like, and honestly, like, it's probably the correct play the majority of the time, because the likelihood that you have Grasp in your hand out of, maybe you've seen like 12 cards in your deck or whatever, is not super high, right?
I mean, if I kept my hand, there's a good chance it's got Grasp.
You could, you could maybe think that.
I wasn't hard mulliganing to Grasp, but I was definitely, I wasn't keeping a hand that didn't have some way to stop the card.
Yeah, yeah. I think Split Moon's deck in particular more than Chef's deck, because there are different decks. I think Split Moon's deck is the deck where it's like you need to be doing something to stop what this deck is doing or you're going to lose. Like it just doesn't matter. Like you can't aggro them down. You can't one for one them. You need like some kind of big masterstroke that's going to like just totally shut them down. Or otherwise they have enough card draw, they have enough mana generation that they're going to be able to fight through your one for ones. So I think Singrasp was like massive, massive workhorse there.
Absolutely.
I also don't think it was a silver bullet as someone who had three Singrasps and ways of tutoring them and very much died in that matchup. Like Split Moon in particular has a lot of counter magic. So I had at least one moment. I don't think I ever got a Sing's Grasp off, but I tried to.
Oh, okay. You know what?
That's why I said the density of interaction was the other really big deal there. Just having more answers than Split Moon has.
Yeah, and I actually remember when I was commentating the match, I thought that this was like in game one, right? Split Moon had four main deck Cursor Glance and then negates in the sideboard, and Split Moon got destroyed by the Singularity's Grasp X equals 2, right? Cursor Glance misses that. So I thought that the best sideboard plan for Split Moon would just be to switch out the Cursor Glances with negates, keep everything else the same. But what Split Moon did was they actually sided out like artifact pieces for negates and kept the glances in. And I thought that was a mistake because I was like, really, the only thing you really care about countering in this matchup is Singrasp. And like, most of this other stuff doesn't really stop you. So, I'm not using this as anecdotal evidence, but in game three, Split Moon ended up drawing all four Cursory Glances and then had to sit there and watch the Singrasp for X equals 2 come down and just stare at their four Cursory Glances. And I felt so bad, but I was also like, oh, I was right, but like in a very anecdotal kind of way.
And see, I disagree with you for two reasons. The first is, you know, if those were more artifact pieces, Split Moon still dies to Sync Grasp.
Yeah, but at least the deck is...
Okay, And the second is that running Cursory Glances means that Split Moon doesn't have to waste negates countering Petflips.
I guess, honestly, I feel like most of the time you don't even need to counter Petflip.
I don't know. I feel like, so my experience with decks like that, not necessarily that specific matchup, because there were so many things that I wanted to spend removal on that I wasn't firing it off willy-nilly. One of the things that you can just do to decks like that is sometimes you just ponza them, because so much of their mana is tied up in being artifacts, and they need the ability to get off the ground and hit these like mana thresholds. If you have some things that are just like my get out of jail free things, like
Nature's Claim.
That's the one green destroy target. Nature's Grasp. Nature's Claim, thank you. If you have Nature's Claim or Singularity's Grasp as your this is my delete button, and then you're just firing off Pithwills to like answer like rail lines or literally anything that deck is doing to try to build up its mana, that can usually give you a really strong edge into being able to beat that deck. I think one thing people don't value enough in MSEM in general is the impact of constraining someone's mana. I'm not saying like people should be running four spikes to four spike turn one rail lines, but
I mean Cosmic Sinkhole is one
rail line. I was throwing stolen
or
sorry. Oh, I was just gonna say I think Cosmic Sinkhole is criminally underrated. I think that card is like insane levels of good, and I'm the only person who's ever played it, to my knowledge. Okay, well you don't count. You're smart.
I have also registered that.
I was throwing stolen secrets at rail lines, and that felt great.
Yep, it just
that bot. I think doing game anything. Two, it was that bought me crucial time. Might have been game three.
If your opponent is ever allowed to cast a spell and you die, it's because you let them cast a spell. Once again, this podcast is not the official stance of this podcast isn't play Ponza.
Speak for yourself.
But
hey, it's one third play Ponza.
I'm fine with my opponents casting spells. I'm just not fine with them resolving spells.
A classic.
And then I ran back into Dodger and died slightly.
Actually, we had a very close match, I think. I think that, honestly, so this is going to sound kind of humble-braggy, but I actually think that I made a pretty smart innovation on my sideboard plan in our match that was different than how I sideboarded in the first match that ended up essentially winning me the last game. Instead of running Knight of Order in my main deck, I actually swapped them out for Bearer of the Lantern, which is a bit of a head-scratcher because it's like, well, obviously you're the beatdown in this matchup, so why are you bringing in your life gain? But really, like, size deck is just trying to one-for-one me, right? And get to a point where they can cast their board wipes and then just finish me off, ideally with a glitch or something, right? So being two bodies, being something that can stick around after the Syngrasp hits, just brought me a lot of value because I just cast it on turn three, attacked for two for the next couple turns, built up the rest of my board. The Syngrass came out, and then I just sacked the extra body to Deadwood Terror to bring it back. And at that point, Zai was out of cards. So I think that...
Yeah. I also feel like, to a very big extent, I lost that match because I made more mistakes than you.
Yeah, I agree. I think... Well, there was a game, too, where I played a tap land.
Classic.
I think, or like a land that couldn't produce black. I made a misplay.
I made a land. Yeah, I played my first land. I played a white source instead of a black source.
Then I
had seal in hand.
Right. So then I main phase Persevere, because I'd been burned before where I tried to end step Persevere and then got sealed. Right. And I knew that you had seal in your sideboard, so I was like, okay, it's just better to main phase the Persevere. But like, you could have actually just had seal there anyway, I think, and that would have probably lost me the game, just based on what was in my hand, I think. Yeah.
There was a couple of times I traded things for Deadwood Terrors because I forgot it had Death
Touch. Oh yeah, that was pretty rough.
I made, you know, maybe four or five mistakes over the course of that match, and Dodger made one or two.
Yeah.
And that's really all it takes, because...
Yeah. I'm a big proponent of the best way to win a bunch of matches of Magic is to just make fewer mistakes than all of your opponents. And as long as you're playing a deck that is vaguely reasonable and you make fewer mistakes... You're probably fairly likely to win. I'm not going to say you're going to. Magic's a game with a metric ton of variance, and you could always, you know, get magicked. You could always draw nothing but lands for the entire game. But I think the number of matches, or games, but also like matches in general, that boil down to one person getting lucky or unlucky is really overstated. I think the vast majority of matches of Magic have specific things that you could have optimized slightly better, and there's literally no way to know whether or not it mattered. And I think people are a little bit too quick to write off their mishaps as luck, which is something I told myself repeatedly throughout this GP as I did poorly, is, okay, well, there's probably things to learn here.
Well, I mean, so like, head state for sure. The way I see it is...
Before we move on, I want to give really big props to Dodger for extremely tight play.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I was pretty proud of how I played in that match, too. I think I was doing a good job playing with my mono fetches in particular, because I think those lands can be pretty steel testing.
Yes.
But like, I think I was holding it up pretty much all the time. And I fetched for Cradle at the correct moment. Remember all my Cradle triggers. I can't think of a mistake that I made that match, but there probably was at least one. I just didn't catch it.
I remember, I don't remember exactly the situation, but I remember at one point thinking that was the wrong reanimation target.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe.
But again, I can't remember the exact details of the situation. It might have been the
performer. I remember I reanimated a performer one time, and then I got immediately killed. Yeah.
Yes, that... And you had an option that would have given you immediate value. I think it was an Anish too.
Yeah. So I remember I went for the first, my reasoning was basically like, okay, if Sai does have removal, right, the benefit to Anish too over a performer is I get a surveil. But if Sai doesn't have removal, the benefit is I win the game. Because performer will attack for like a
but if
million.
You flip the Anish 2 you also
yeah but not
win
but not
game.
Immediately because Anish 2, you I think you were at high enough life where Anish 2 wouldn't have immediately killed and that gives you another turn to draw into out of body experience or something. So I don't know, that was the calculation in my head, maybe it's not correct, but I did have reasoning for that play. Cool. I guess I should talk about my GP, right?
To the extent I haven't already talked about it, yeah.
Yeah, so all things considered, went pretty well. I think the deck was positioned like remarkably well in this meta. Like better than I expected, actually. Because part of the reason I brought the deck was because I knew that there were going to be decks that I needed to have the answers for. But I also needed to be a reasonable deck that wasn't just relying on running essentially a bunch of hate pieces. And I thought that the best way to do this was actually just to run discard. So I wanted to play a deck with black, and black also luckily has access to several like other good removal spells that are pretty catch-all. And just in black-white, you had access to both Pithbolt and Journey's End, which I believe are probably the two best spot removal spells in the format currently, after Journey's End was recently buffed. So what I did was I had been tinkering with this Unearth shell. The previous version had a package with Ambitious Necromancer and Deformed Sanity. It was pretty explosive if you got it working, because you could Deformed Sanity with Ambitious Necromancer in play and then immediately reanimate whatever you discarded. But I think that those cards in particular weren't performing well when you didn't draw the other half. So I ended up cutting them, and I ran I think I put in Oracle's Vision and Anish 2's. Yeah. And I think that was the correct decision. So my first match was against Ruben. And I was kind of kicking myself a little bit because I had cut Memento Moris for my sideboard to put in Curse of the Drow, which I thought would be a better answer against like control for sure, but also the combo artifact decks. And I ended up was like, oh shit, I just took out my Grave Hate. I'm now relying on a single main deck Corpse Bed to fight this reanimator deck. And in case you don't know what Ruben's deck does, basically it uses a reanimator shell to cheat out Spellmaster, Ethereal Spellmaster, which then can just get a clone spell, in this case Vivid Mirage, to copy itself, and then copy gets another Vivid Mirage, and then it just instantly kills you. Yeah. So luckily, actually, my draw in game one was basically drop a Deadwood Terror, attack. When Ruben goes for the combo, all I have to do is hold up a Murky Pete, and then I can just fetch Corpse Bed and essentially counter the reanimation spell. So I kind of played like a tempo deck, basically. But in game two, I remember there was a very strange game where I kept a hand with three discard spells. I think it was two Stolen Secrets and a Duress. And I led with the Duress on turn one, found that Ruben had kept a hand with like four lands, reanimation spell, Vivid Mirage. And I was like, okay, easy win. I take your reanimation spell and then just, do my thing. But what ended up happening was a series of draws where I didn't really find any threats. And then I chose not to take the Vivid Mirage because I just assumed it was dead in hand. But what Ruben did was play a Nebula of Empty Gold and cast the Vivid Mirage targeting a fetch and cast it off of a Deadwood Grove and the Nebula, then using the Vivid Mirage fetch trick to get two more lands, then eventually hardcast a top decked Ethereal Spellmaster. So that was a very weird game, where I actually got punished by not taking the Vivid Mirage. So that was definitely a misplay, I think. And then in game three, I don't remember exactly what happened. I kind of just, my deck did its thing. Let's see, round two I played against actually the mirror match because Gender Terrorist was running my old version of Black White Unearth with the Ambitious Necromancers and the Deformed Sanities, and I think it kind of showed why my new version was better because I had Nishtu, who is frankly insane, and the Deformed Sanities didn't quite line up in the best way, I think. Just with how Gender Terrorist got the draws. And I think I knew the deck a little bit better, so I was able to maneuver the match better than they were. So I ended up taking that one. The third match I played against Infamous Gengar, who was on the Killing Ground deck, which I think was a very strong deck, as evidenced by the I got to the finals. And in particular, like, if you don't have the tools to fight this deck, it will just... Like, what you need are... either an abundance of lightning, abundance of cheap, preferably instant speed removal, or counter spells. And luckily, I had a deck that lined up very well into this deck with Deadwood Terror, because if you unearth a Deadwood Terror on turn one or two, Umbrota Goliath just goes like, well, shit, that's three Death Touchers. Like, can't really do anything about that. So I think that the deck lined up very well into killing. So that was a 2-0 as well, I think. Round four, I played Cyber. We already talked about this. In general, I think round four was like kind of doing its thing. In game one, the crazy thing is that the deck grinds, which is just something that you don't expect a deck full of 2 and 3 drops to do when you're facing off against 5 color control. You know, and I think that really speaks to the power of Deadwood Terror, whereas like sometimes even if you get like 1-for-1 and you haven't been able to win the game, Deadwood Terror can just grind people out if they don't have an exile.
You have a lot of 3-for-1s
in practice. And like Performer, when flipped, it synergizes really well with Deadwood Terror. There's a ton of reach and life gain available too, because Inishitu and Performer both can gain you a bunch of life. And then Bloodjade Prophet gives you a bunch of extra card advantage too. Then round five, it was a match against Split Moon. I offered to draw in case they wanted to. I didn't really care about playing the match or not because I was already locked. But Split Moon decided to draw. So I actually never played against Blue Red Artifacts, even though part of the reason I played the deck was supposedly because of its good matchup against Blue Red Artifacts. I think I probably could have won that game, would have depended on my play and draws and stuff like that. In quarters, I was matched against Dredge, and I was like, ah, shit, I am once again being punished for not running my Memento Moris. And then I was once again surprised at how good Corpse Bed is. And honestly, I think people should just be running Corpse Bed in almost every black deck that runs a good amount of fetches. It is just... It is so... Oh, sorry.
I very much agree with that. Corpse Bed is amazing. If you can afford to run a land that only produces black and enters tapped, you should be running Corpse Bed.
It's just like, literally Corpse Bed by itself was enough for me to beat Dredge. Like, cause I had no grave hate in the sideboard. I was essentially just relying on like getting the Deadwood Terrors out to block the Goliaths. And then post-board, I at least had Bear of Lantern, too, that could block. I think I ended up taking that match in a 2-0. I can't remember exactly. In the semifinals, I faced Cyber. That was probably my closest match of the tournament. I think that in game two, especially, if Cyber had gotten the turn one seal of two, I probably would have lost. I think Cyber won game one, right? I'm not crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, but you sideboard very well against me. Yeah.
Okay, and then the finals, I was up against Elmaquino, who was once again on Killing Ground. And as I described before, I think that the deck just stomps Killing Ground. Like, it just has all the answers. the only way you could possibly lose is if you get like wrecked by the Sinister Pact combo on turn three. And I was able to dodge that, and I was also able to get two Deadwood Terror every game. So pretty straightforward 2-0 in the finals. But yeah, overall, I had a lot of fun with this deck. I think that it's still very much viable, even with the removal of Torment Lands. It just means you need to reassess. Well, because there were some games where I didn't even torment out anything early, right? It just means you need to reassess, like, maybe I need a little bit more ways to get stuff into the grave. But besides that, I think the deck's still very, very good. I think Inishtu is actually the best 2-drop in the format, which is a bit of a hot take, but I just think Inishtu is so good, and people need to be playing it more than it's currently being played.
So earlier you said that Theocracy was the second best card in Scriptures of Earth.
Inishtu is the best card in Scriptures. It is ludicrous. You get this floor, right? The floor is a 2-mana 2/3 with Surveil 1. The ceiling is you spent 2 mana on a threat that is indestructible. It can attack past most things. It's resistant to removal, and it just has like this way of you're never going to run out of cards in your graveyard realistically before your opponent's dead. And it just has so much extra reach attached to it, like that you're giving up very little for running this 2-drop in your deck, even if you never flip it. And it does often just win you the game when you flip it.
It's
right.
The flipped side is very similar to Hazoret, but kind of just better. So the way you need to evaluate this card is, would I be willing to spend 2 mana on a card that's going to turn into Hazoret?
And even if it never turns into Hazoret, yes. It's not a bad
No, it is a very, I mean, I think yes, it's way better than Warfield.
I like Excavator a lot.
And people were playing that card
I've never ages. Actually
people should not have been playing Warfield Excavator for ages.
I think my one disagreement is I think you're kind of underselling Chi Li. I think Chi Li is an answer or die threat in a way that Inishtu isn't.
Yeah.
Because Inishtu isn't answer or die on turn 2. Like, you have to answer Inishtu by turn, you know, 4 or 5-ish, but you get a bit of time. You want to answer him fast because he does have an attack trigger, but it's not Chi Li levels. Where it's Chi Li attacks,
I think
there's now a 4/4 that.
So I think that the factor that pushes it over for me is that Chi Li is much worse if you're not playing it on turn 2. And it also is much worse on the draw.
Chi Li is a great top
I agree.
Late game also.
I mean, it's not horrible. It's just like a slow 4/4.
I mean, Chi Li is great.
It's an art. Well, it's as many slow 4/4s as you can get away.
It's not going to attack in and not die. If you're casting on turn 6.
I mean, if you're casting it turn 6 after a board.
So basically, there are two scenarios where Chi Li... So there are two scenarios where Chi Li is broken. The two scenarios are on turn 2, especially when you're on the play. Like, that card, if you're on the draw versus her, and you're not packing a bunch of interaction, it's going to be lights out. And the other circumstances, once both players are out of resources. And that's why I think the good Chi Li decks run so much discard. Because if you can engineer a game state where you and your opponent don't have anything left, because you've one for one them bunch, you've shredded their hand, both of you are top decking, Chi Li is better than most top decks. And if your opponent stumbles, if Chi Li attacks and doesn't die,
yeah, agreed.
It is almost
Chi Li also triggers parrot pools, which I know should appeal to Roger.
Strictly better than Inishtu, who does not trigger parrot pools. But I think the fact that we're even having this conversation about is Inishtu better than Chi Li or not, like, is insane given how premium of a threat Chi Li has been, basically forever. And then the fact that Chile is two colors and Anishtu is, you know, one. And Chile dies
to Anishtu also dies to Mpumo. Well, having exiled multiple Anishtus with Mpumo this GP.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Dying to Mpumo plus feels so much worse than dying to Mpumo minus.
Both of them on the really other bad, hand, if you're on the like, play with Chile, making people exile the demon and then get their Mpumo killed by the Chile feels great.
Making another demon in the process, like, yeah, there's not really good options. Like, oh, I can uptick and kill Chile and die to the demon. Okay, that one's not good. What's the other option? Oh, the other option's also bad. So we've kind of danced around it or made reference to it, but I'm going to shift our agenda slightly. And I think the next thing we should talk about are some of the bans that just happened. And what that kind of means, what can we learn from this GP? Because of the best decks in this GP, the vast majority of them are receiving bans or nerfs that just slaughter them. You know, for instance, Desperado is being basically fixed. I don't think that Killing Ground is a particularly good deck when it can't, you know, Desperado nuke you out of nowhere. I think that, you know, all of the decks in the top 8 that heavily utilize Torment Lands, you know, I believe you that the Black White Unearth deck didn't rely on Torment Lands, but the fact that you have so much cheese potential from, you know, Black Torment Land, discard any of my threats, Unearth as a Dark Ritual, you know, good fucking luck.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Deadwood Terrors.
100%.
Like, that's undeniably powerful. The fact that the deck has a fair game plan, you know, it makes it good. But if that deck didn't
agreed
have the unfair
I think that,
game plan,
deck,
I don't think it would have won the GP.
What now makes the deck worse is that you actually have to spend some real estate to make sure you can reliably get those cards into your graveyard. And it's not like your lands are just randomly doing it for you. And then it also removes the cheese potential that you just mentioned. So it's definitely weaker. I still think it's playable, but it's not like going to be dominating the meta anytime soon.
And on the note of dominating meta, the Supreme Mechanothurge deck got gutted. Both the fact that Supreme Mechanothurge got a, you know, quote unquote bug fix, because Mako seriously hadn't considered the fact it could go into it with, you know, a Stiff Breeze. Blue red artifact decks in general, which have made their appearance known for the past like 2 or 3 GPs in a very serious way, lost 11th Hour Breakthrough, which has been one of the consistent themes throughout all of these decks. Between that and losing Relicise going up to 5 mana, which now is even harder to ritual into, Reinvent being blue-blue X, which honestly still seemed really absurd in those decks, but I'm sure is a
hub of innovation being harder to turn on.
Hub of innovation, I think, will probably get cut from a lot of those decks. Like,
it is getting MS3.
We kind of gutted the blue red artifact.
Hold out for that one.
if you like to play that deck, play
well,
MS3,
also depending on the
awesome
bonus sheet, we may get a couple
get
new cards
Storm Unlimited,
that
and that's
might
what
revitalize the archetype.
Be fairly safe in terms of cards we allow in. I'm not going to say that if a card looks good in blue-red artifacts, we're not going to let it in, but I would be vaguely surprised if, you know,
yeah, we're not going to get, like, 11th
Hour 2.0. Gets anything near...
But,
on the other hand, we do miss things. It's entirely possible we could accidentally give the deck something exciting.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at... did the MS1 bonus sheet have any issues? Because the MS2 bonus sheet brought with it Plasma Addict and
the Planeswalker Rainzai.
But like, she's a distant third compared to those. Oh, Rainzai, pre-nerf Rainzai. It brought Mpumo, and also I forgot that there's
the Scrapyard Sovereign
card on our ban list from
that's
MS1
not really Scrapyard's fault though. I think it's Dead Man's fan's fault.
Yeah, so
that is definitely Scrapyard's. I mean, the thing is, it does that with Time Cube also, both, even like, if you get rid of
Yeah, Bandcamp. Okay, I guess, yeah.
Scrapyard solving, I mean, really, if we want to be fair, yeah, it's actually yeah, a two-mana reanimation
spell.
That's
probably the correct
answer. If
I played the deck that hard passed Scrapyard Sovereign, it was a bad deck.
I think it's funny that Scrapyard Sovereign is on the ban list, but Ethereal Spellmaster, which is that with fewer
Well,
hoops,
so Spellmaster is Spellmaster, real? At least you can... you can technically interact with Scrapyard in a similar way. Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. all the ways you can beat Scrapyard... all the ways you can beat Ethereal Spellmaster apply to...
I guess the other argument...
With the exception
stuff
of
that counters instants and sorceries doesn't necessarily work against Scrapyard Sovereign.
Yeah, if you're playing Neutralize because you really hate one yeah. particular
well,
type
I think, of deck, I think Spellmaster also like does take a lot of deck-building real estate. Like, it does require you to run a playset of clone effects and then, you know, a couple of the copy of your tokens cards.
But in practice, Sovereign does too. Like, I've tried building the version of the deck.
Yeah, Sovereign, you need to run
runs the minimal Sovereign package. It is not enough.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Because you're relying on the... Anyway, it's... I suppose this is all just tangent. But I guess my big question is, what did we learn from this GP that can tell us things about the format going forward? You know, what were the big lessons learned that people can apply to their deck building and stuff? Or were the nerfs and bans such that a lot of lessons that could have been learned...
I will point out that my deck was still completely legal.
Yanked out from under us.
I would not recommend playing it with exactly its current mana base. You know, make better choices about which duels you include, but it works.
Yeah, so didn't you talk about how Terraformers Globe actually
kind of
is not necessary to make that deck's mana base work?
You need at least two Terraformers Globes to reliably hit Glitch on 6 loyalty. If you're not trying to, you can pretty
gotcha.
Reliably hit
but
4
you can
to 5
hit
loyalty,
four loyalty
even without
otherwise?
The Globes. You can pretty reliably play your Hellion Devastators with no Globes at all.
So in terms of the whole, like, oh, well, Globe's going to ruin the mana base.
Yeah.
any
mana base where you take out
broken
Glitch,
already.
You can also take out the Globes.
So I think...
Exactly.
And that's just
hitting
Glitch is effectively...
Hitting Wooburg on turn five,
hitting five
is difficult. The Globes really help you get there. Hitting, you know, one and Jund on turn four is not that hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's never been in question that three color cards are easy to hit. I think the concerning thing is something similar to Lorwyn era five color control, where you're curving, you know, not pip dense cards, but cards
yeah.
with a lot of.
I mean, some
curving,
of those cards
were
the other. So curving
you know, Mpumo into Hellion, you know, yeah, Mpumo into Hellion Devastator, say.
Well,
yeah,
I think actually I would disagree on the pip dense thing because like. Those decks would go turn 6 Cloud Thresher and then turn 7 play Cruel Ultimatum. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's not something
that
MCM mana bases can do, like, really, which is something, I guess.
So actually, they can, they just have to be three colors.
So
yeah, well, like...
Well, no, actually.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
We can do the exact same thing. The issue is it involves tap lands. We have Vivid Lands and we have Reflecting Pool or a Reflecting Pool like the so the thing that made the Lorwyn five color control deck broken is that there wasn't much to punish it if it played two tapped lands to start the game and then on turn three start just casting the best spells
right.
in its color combinations every single step along the way including like Bloom Veil on three but the difference in MCM is if your plan is to play, you know, your first two lands tapped, you're probably going to die. It's not a guarantee, but I am of a strong opinion that if you're not doing literally anything in the first two turns of the game, like you're not interacting, you're not setting up for a really good turn three, you're not playing out a threat that your opponent needs to think about, I think it is very difficult for decks to not put you in a very difficult position starting turn three. Or in some cases,
that said, you don't really need to be doing something on turn three.
Right. You can skip your turn one if you have meaningful interaction on turn two. But so I guess my point is the only thing stopping those ridiculously pip dense sort of decks from happening in this format is one, restraint on the part of deck building. I know that I will repeatedly look at cards and think, I could technically afford this per the Karsten math, but it's not worth the like 10% risk of failure because the Karsten math has that 10% risk of failure, I think. He has a pretty large margin for what he considers an acceptable amount.
Percentage. I think it's 9%, but it's basically. I think 10% is the point at which it is considered not good enough.
Yeah.
And so any single digit percent is considered an acceptable failure.
And 9% is fine. So kind of building off of that, I think the things that are stopping those ridiculously pip dense decks from happening are A, some amount of restraint on the part of deck builders, and B, just the lack of ridiculously good pip dense cards. Like, we don't have Cryptic Command. We have a lot more cards that are three different colors.
Hey, we have Epic of Ekrabram. That's color,
you know, three triple density. Yeah, totally. I would point towards Herzi's five color control deck, which had Heraldry as one of its primary finishers. And that deck had no trouble casting its spells. I never saw that deck screw up its mana. And I saw it actually mess up other people's mana all the time with Mirror Gates, because when you're reflecting pool, sometimes mana screws your opponent. That would probably make Lorwyn Standard both a lot more and a lot less interesting.
Wait, her second Heraldry?
You're talking about
a league deck.
So, you know, maybe when the...
Oh, okay.
Not this GP. Yeah, I'm talking about a league deck that Herzi was bring, but got concerned at the last second that people were bringing a bunch of non-basic hate, which
nobody actually plays ever. Non-basic hate.
So I guess one of the first lessons I guess to draw from this GP is you can go greedy. Five color control has top aided this GP. The last time someone brought five color control to a GP was when I got second with it. When I had access to, you know, unnerfed Golden Glade and Northern Holdout. So it is a deck with a pedigree in the format. I'm not going to say, like, you know, therefore it's secret OP, bring it and you'll top eight your next GP. But I think it isn't a risk. I don't think you should look in and go, ah, man, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. The only thing to worry about is the question of, is this worth it? What do I gain from being fewer?
Honestly, though,
I didn't feel like I could justify running Corpse Bed in this deck.
I think that's a fair assumption.
I felt like I got one utility land slot, and Nereba was a better pick than Corpse Bed.
Yeah, also, like, a much lower percentage of your fetches get Corpse Bed, so that's another thing. Like,
if I had actually... If I had known, you know, which seven decks I was going to be matched up against, I would have taken the Corpse Bed.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, yeah.
But, you know, into a blind field, Nereba is definitely the better pick.
So I have a couple things. I think on a personal level, I learned a couple things to improve my play, one of which is to kind of, like, be a little more considerate of playing around specific cards from your opponent's sideboard. For instance, I think that early on in the GP, I was just always end phasing Persevere, but like towards the end of the GP, I was playing it correctly where I was just main phasing it to avoid the potential seal. And I think that another thing that I've that is really fucking good. It is good enough to single-handedly as your grave hate versus dedicated graveyard decks. Even decks like Dredge, as long as you're smart about, you know, using your mono fetches properly, and you have enough fetches in your deck that you can reliably find one, and still have your function without actually cracking the fetch.
I'm going to slightly push back, and I'm going to say that it depends on the rest of your deck, because I think your deck has a powerful enough fair plan that it can actually, if you stop Dredge's broken starts, you can usually beat their more fair starts. But I don't want the takeaway from this podcast for anyone to be, oh, well,
so,
I put a
set in my deck. To be clear, I'm not saying
graveyard decks. Those graveyard decks must
to be clear, I'm not saying don't run
Grave Hate. It's more complicated.
I'm saying run Corpse Bed. And I just think that, like, my deck in particular, looking back, I'm pretty happy that I decided to run the Curse of the Drow instead of Memento Mori, at least in the matchups I played, because I was still able to beat Dredge pretty handily without Memento Mori. But I do think that, like, my deck is probably not the average deck that, like, at least in how in terms of how it would perform versus Dredge without any Grave Hate.
I think one of the big lessons for me here, I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly, but people are bad at sideboarding. I think the fact that this was a blind sideboard event, and that meant that also people were asking for less help in terms of sideboards, meant that a lot of people were
sideboards
that just felt kind of all over the place.
I was running sudden decompression in my sideboard.
There was
that card's OP. What are you talking about? That card destroyed me in field.
I don't have a good
answer. Touch.
That card destroyed me in
field. I mean, okay, it is good against
mediocre in draft.
It stole my pernicious primivore.
Exactly, Dodger's deck.
No, I was playing in field and it stole my pernicious primivore, and I cried.
Well,
it was augmented. Yeah.
Did it hit five color? Was it augmented or was it just a discard spell? Okay, yeah, that's insane.
They did it on turn three good game. Too. It was like they did Nebulous Call until Blind Dreaming.
How did they have Wooburg on turn three?
Yeah, and then just ran out the...
Oh my god.
I think it was...
Yeah. Wow. So Nebulous Call, Dreams of Greatness...
I think it was
Wow,
JN
that is actually
that
just straight up augmented on turn three. Yikes.
That sounds like something JN would do.
That sounds... I would also point, like, some people clearly boarded for decks that weren't there.
It's legitimately which, hard,
you know, I think
to
it's
determine
somewhat
what's going
to
be played a lot of the time
because no one but in general that just means that I think people should hedge towards more less narrow cards. Like, there were...
Yeah, I don't think that's something you should bring to a blind sideboard event.
There were elixirs of
ambition
in this GP. And I personally don't think it's something you should bring even when you... Like, even if you know someone in your event is on turns, I think it is really difficult to just
wait.
That card.
I mean,
there's
like,
a reason it has,
like,
a 25% win rate.
It's a meta thing.
I don't think
there
were. Who had elixirs?
You know what?
Did no one have elixir?
You're thinking of the card in Frogmaker's deck that has the same art. Oh, really?
Okay. Caillou had an Arcane.
No,
I am not.
I know that one.
Of,
that you're...
But that's actually
there's no elixir. There's no elixir in the GP.
No. Okay. Huh. Never mind.
I do agree with your large
last GP,
your overall point
else
about sideboards.
There were some whack sideboard picks in here. But
I also think numbers were really rough. I think some people had too many cards for a given slot. Like, you know, they 4X'd something that they really only wanted two copies of. And I think to some extent, like, I think that combined with the fact that really good pilots were on linear decks and combined with the fact that the linear decks had a lot of really powerful cards that hadn't been addressed, I think there's a reason we saw one of the least fair top eights that we've seen.
Is it compared to GP Lafayette, though? That one was also pretty unfair.
And I think... Yeah, that's fair. Well, not that, but I think I think it's one of those things where it's something on the order of every three or four GPs feels like it has.
Actually, I'm 2 for 2 on ridiculously,
unfair top eight.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, I definitely think there's some analysis to be done there in terms of what about you as a player allows you to thrive in those circumstances, but that seems like a later deep dive episode. But I guess in general, part of my takeaway here is if you aren't sure of how to sideboard, just talk to people. You don't actually gain enough by keeping things secret in this format than you do by just getting information. People drastically overthink the level of competition and like optimization that other people are going to do. I can tell you for a fact that the majority of people aren't going to change their decks based on what deck they hear you playing, because that's not why people are playing their decks. Most people play their decks because they enjoy playing them. No one here is trying to go full spike. Otherwise we would have seen more people on Mechano Thurge combo. So I guess my big takeaway here is work hard on your sideboards, and if you feel like you can't figure out how to sideboard better, literally just go into deck building, put your cards on the table, and ask. And I, at the very least, will be happy to help.
Something that I benefited a lot from, actually. I feel like this is the first GP where my sideboard wasn't bad. And I think that... Actually, my Wonderful sideboard was fine. But I think that, like, a big part of that goes out to Egg, because Egg and I, like, helped each other tune our sideboards for the event. And I actually think Egg's Jun deck is really underrated. I think that if Egg hadn't gotten matched up against the Frogmaker deck, which I think is kind of like a nightmare matchup for Jun, Egg could have pretty reasonably top aided this event as well. So I don't remember. I can search that right now, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's see. From LackeyBot.
Yeah.
Mentions. All right. How do I do? Like, at. I think mentions is right. Right.
Yeah, okay, it's mentions. Mentions.
Yeah. Okay. It looks like Egg lost to Blues Eclipse in round 2. 2-1. Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's losing towards
probably not in Jun's favor. So you know, I don't. Really stuff. Think eh, maybe I don't know yeah probably 50-50.
It totally depends on how both their builds it could range from Jund is 60-40 favored, it could range from Jund is 40-60 unfavored. It totally depends on both
Decks, I do want to say
on paper is
sort of
good or bad
on the note of you know, we had a very unfair top eight. Don't let that discourage you from playing fair decks. You can absolutely still do very well with fair decks in MSEM. They are completely viable. You know, I was playing, you know, a very fair deck. I lost to a deck that in large part beat me because it was better at playing fair magic than mine.
I was going to say, I think one of the reasons that Dodger's deck was successful was because of that fair magic plan and the fact that it had so much respect for other decks in terms of its...
Yeah, which is actually pretty out of character.
It wasn't trying to just go vroom vroom linear.
But yeah, I was super happy. I think I was really happy with all the numbers in the main. I think like 3 Pithbolt, 3 Journey's End felt very good. Those two together answer pretty much everything you want to answer with the exception of Planeswalkers, but you also have a 4-pack of Stolen Secrets in the main, and then tons of discard in the sideboard, too. So I felt very... sorry.
I mean, the other... I was going to say, the other big answer for Planeswalkers that I think your deck epitomizes is you play to the board a lot. So,
yeah.
Planeswalkers...
Yep. Oracle's Vision into Pithbolt also answers a lot of the Planeswalkers you care about in a pinch.
Yeah, that's true. I never did Oracle's Vision into Fifth Wall.
And the five color one that starts with V.
My, like, in terms of playable cards,
Veller or whatever. Valier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
If they resolve that card, you probably
just you're getting that one though. Like, just accept it. Move on in life. Sometimes you'll feel like you're winning. There's a good chance that's because they're choosing the wrong abilities. The second they realize which abilities to use, you're dead. I think building on that and kind of related to the other point that I was making earlier is one of the things that can cause these kind of unfair decks to bubble to the top is a slightly misspelt unfair deck is going to be light years better than a slightly misspelt fair deck. And as a result, I think if you want to play Fair Magic, which you should, Fair Magic is really fun to play in this format. You get access to a lot of absurd tools. You have these like really sweet, like drawn out punching games. Put more time into your decks. I think this is bad.
Don't do that. My decks would be so much better if I lives on time building decks
2 hours before the deadline. yeah. If you think going into a GP that you might want to play control, I would like, highly recommend building it and then showing it off and seeing if anyone else has thoughts and then playing a couple of games with it and just realizing, huh, I don't want that fetch land, or yeah, it turns out the win con I picked is kind of bad, or oh, huh, Children of the Clouds exists. I really should have registered that. Like, all of those sorts of moments can and will happen to you, and I would drastically suggest not having those moments.
If you're not a grad student, you should be testing your decks.
That should be one of the problems.
that's my stance here. I would pay, you know, a white mana, a black mana, a man of any color. That seems legit. Man of any type.
A man of any color or colorless, because colorless is not a color. Anyway, the final, like, so I don't think we super have time to get into the other topic that we wanted to discuss, which was who were the real winners of this GP, kind of on a conceptual level, what decks looked the scariest, you know, etc. We kind of touched on that indirectly through this entire thing, though. But I think kind of closing things up, looking forward to the next GP, I would be at least mildly, perhaps substantially shocked if we again break our records. And honestly, I'd be fairly surprised if we hit our record again. But with that said, you know, just an abstract, since it's a week away.
I have no idea.
How prepared do you guys feel?
I know exactly what I'm going to be doing. I'll be building a deck 2 hours before the deadline.
Yeah, I actually haven't been building decks for a while. I've made one today. Excellent. It's like an Unearthed Parapools deck. So obviously nothing I've done before. But it's running Entrail Elemental, and it's also running Emissary of Antiquities. Yeah. So it's kind of like a weird hybrid thing. I decided to main deck 4 Vibrant Flames because I think Vibrant Flames is sweet. And I don't know. I was gonna run through a league, but I still have no idea. Like, basically what I'm just gonna do is just gonna make some decks, run them through leagues, and then probably pick the one that plays the best. Or I'll just pull a Chonkord and build my deck the day before.
Reminder that Vibrant Flames, you have to pay the additional cost if you're casting.
I'm just gonna be exiling multicolor. I'm not running I cut into Reedy Valley from the deck. So I don't care about I also cut. I built base red, so I cut Wheat from Chaff too, which might have been a mistake, but
makes it a bit.
I think Oracle's plus Unquenched is probably enough anyway. I don't know. I want to give it a try, but I think this deck could be sweet.
More seriously, I'm almost certainly going to be playing another deck with an absurdly greedy mana base because you can absolutely get away with it.
I'm trying to decide really what I want to do. I'm inclined towards trying to play control decks again.
The fact I had a lot of difficulty doing that in League last month honestly is not super indicative, I think, of what GPs look like based on so historically speaking, Leagues usually have had a lot rougher decks than GPs, and I think that's slowly stopped becoming true. And I think there are some decks where, I don't know what it is, it's probably just the difference of open deck list, but there are some decks that you'll encounter in League.
Yeah, like my Monza deck from League, it only works.
They would just seem so much less scary.
because the whole plan is trying to trick them with the sideboard.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of lose that edge. Yeah, that's true.
You can still mind games, people. Yeah. The other thing that I would point to is like Podlight, where I have just this insane win record with Podlight in Leagues across Lifetime. And like, I have fine finishes with it in GPs, but nothing as absurd as what I've put up into Leagues with it. So I think also if you're playing Control and you're getting, you know, destroyed in Leagues, don't be too rough on yourself. Like, you're definitely, you should be capable of learning from that, but I don't think it's going to, I don't think you should take it as a sign that you should give up and just,
I wouldn't say, okay, this is,
as tempted as I am to just,
I wouldn't say playing burn is a sign that someone has given up. I think it's a
it's a sign that they have given up. How do you say it?
All right, you know what?
Brewing.
You know what? I'm bringing burn to the next GP. It's going to run none of the cards they will usually run in burn. I'm going to win. Just you watch.
Oh, God. Also, I'm just going to take a stance here.
Challenge
if your burn
accepted.
Deck does not feature a plasma addict,
I'm with Pip on this one.
I mean, Dauntre, Dauntre, you're going to misbuild your deck.
I mean,
it's not going to matter, but it's
look,
going to have been misbuilt.
All I can say is I've only ever played perfect decks. I think that, like, I don't know, Chonkord obviously was basically burn, but it doesn't run plasmatic, so QED.
Yeah, it was. You raise the large
if your deck isn't
point.
Burn, there but is a non-zero chance it should be running Plasma Addict anyway.
I actually disagree with that, based on my experience playing fair kind of like tempo or like aggressive leaning mid-range decks that run Plasma Addict. Because
oh, you know
what
I
want to
play? I want to play Theocracy.
Is you rapidly realize you should just be playing Burn.
Yeah.
You know what you can get off of a Theocracy? It's Plasma Addict.
I mean, yeah,
oh, man.
Like
Plasma Addict is too
I think
dull.
I think five color Theocracy probably exists with like you can run Chili, you can run Plasma Addict, you can run Inishtu, you can run whatever other bullshit, and you can monument everything. I think that deck's probably pretty good.
You can also Savage Congregation them both
what is this
on
card?
The battlefield, although Savcon is not
you can
good,
Savage
so
Congregation
power creatures.
But you can get
so I would recommend finding
what the hell is this?
Oh, man.
Oh, that card's fun. How have I not seen this one before?
So for those of you who are not in on this, Savage Congregation used to do very different things. It has had a storied career over its SEM tenure. And I think it has spent the majority of its tenure banned, or close to it. At least 7 months of its
what,
tenure.
What, did it used to
banned.
Be like based on power?
But it was also in the first like first wave of SEM sets.
Yep.
Ding, ding, ding. So what it used to be is, okay, so the original version, because the very original version was green, 3. Search your library for a creature card with power 4 or less. Reveal it and put it in your hand. If you have Ferocious,
so
it
has
search your
the,
library
it has
for any number of creatures
problem.
With total power 4 or less.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would then discard your hand. You would instantly reanimate them with Manifest Memories, which used to not be an X spell. It just used to hit your entire graveyard for 2 mana.
Cool.
And then you would combo kill them. And it would be painful. That was live for one GP. The next GP saw a different version of Savage Congregation that became meta-defining in its own way. Several different really powerful combo decks slash mid-range decks was the crazy thing. They were combo mid-range, were built on the back of SavCon because it was green-green three, two-door creature with power four or less to the battlefield. Ferocious, you can tutor any number of creatures instead with total power four or less. And then that one was changed and it still had the same first mode, but its second mode could only find up to four creatures. So the card at different stages.
Oh, is this powered the Master Chef deck?
Called Underworld Cookbook, which killed with False Savior, which is basically that one. Yep, that's when Master Chef created two tokens. You could sacrifice spell roots. Your entire combo had Hexproof because of Thorn.
It's like the tavern. It's also Swindler. Why.
It's rock. Exactly. Yeah. It's also why Darkrite Cultist is championed. It was because of that deck, because that was a five power creature that you could easily fit into your combo deck. And then a little bit later, JN made a build of a deck called Savage Bant. It was some play on Savage Congregation and Bant, and had like Snowfield Mother and Helvala as its two enablers. And it had a loop that generated infinite mana with the fact that we had Devoted Druid in the format at that point in time.
RIP.
Yeah, it is no longer in the format. It has been replaced with a not canon staple. And it generated infinite mana. And I'm still 90% sure that deck didn't actually have a legal kill. It had a non-deterministic kill. But, you know, it's fine. I think there was one more Savage Congregation deck that I'm forgetting, though. But the point is,
eventually everyone was like, shut up, Egg. Stop trying to make Fetch happen. Fetch is happening too much.
More or less. The statement was basically, look, Savage Congregation keeps breaking the format. What can we do? And I was like, let's just ban it until I get around to reworking that set.
Rip.
And then the set did not get a rework for a year.
Piece of history.
Yeah. Little history lesson. Should probably do a podcast of those at some point because
play discard. Discard's OP.
All right. Any closing thoughts?
However, I think this has been a point people have made before, but however much discard you have, you probably don't have enough. If you are a like base black deck that is hoping to use discard as your primary axis of interaction, don't just run four Stolen Secrets. It's probably not enough.
If you're running four discard spells, you should either cut them or add another four discard spells.
Yeah, agreed.
So, my current plan for this upcoming GP is I kind of want to try bringing Villainy back. So, over the course of the next couple days, people should either tell me if this is a really bad idea or a really great idea. I think if you think this is a great idea, you're probably, you know, wrong. And I think if you think it's a really bad idea, that's not actually as good of a convincing factor as you think it is. Because
Villainy is a bad card, but you can make a good deck that runs it.
My closing thought is fuck Villainy.
But yeah, you know what I should add to Villainy? Mastery of the Veil. And with that,